we spend a lot of time really focusing on the fact that ERAS is the best patient care according to current best evidence. It is not a project. You are not implementing an ERAS project to see how patients do. The evidence is there. Your patients will do better.
Hi, I'm Christiana, and I'm a nurse at the bedside. Today we're talking about enhanced recovery after surgery. I've been in perioperative care for most of my nursing career, and these days there is a ton of pressure on surgical services. There are a bunch of reasons for this. People are living longer with more complex health problems, the effects of the pandemic, not enough staff, not enough funding. Bottom line is, there's more need than we can handle, and people are suffering, even dying while they wait. So we are searching for efficiencies everywhere. Everywhere. Trying not to sacrifice quality and satisfaction. It's the same old story, only even more. We all want the highest quality care, of course, for our patients and ourselves, because many of us will need surgery in our lifetimes too. How we, as a system, define quality is important, which is probably why so many groups try to influence that definition, like the different health professions, industry, such as medical device, equipment, pharma, the administrators, funders, and regulators, and of course, patients and families and groups of advocates. All of them understand that how we define quality ultimately determines where we focus our attention, resources, what we measure, the standards we measure ourselves against, and how we approach improving. Even just considering my own work as a surgical nurse, it's not always clear how the little things that I do in a day, or don't do, the many decisions that I make, how they impact patient outcomes over time. It's not like there's always an immediate effect. And consider the variation in standards. Like in one place, take the dressing off post-op day 2, wash the incision, leave open to air as much as possible. Another place nearby, leave the dressing in place for 2 weeks, don't move it, don't look under it. Like those are some widely different recommendations. I know which one I think is better. So quality exists in a dynamic, right? Influenced by factors related to the professionals themselves and how they work together, to the patient. Although there are similarities, each person, family, illness presentation is unique and needs to be treated as such, and to the system. To achieve consistent good outcomes, you really need all of these things to be optimized, which, you know, not always the case. And what is considered good care today may just not cut it tomorrow. There's the expectation that we be improving, innovating, learning, both individually and collectively. We're supposed to be getting better at getting people better. One of the mechanisms to support quality is the clinical guideline, to translate research evidence so it is useful to us, the clinicians, to guide our actions and our decisions, and to serve as a comparison so we can better understand our and our program's performance. Every specialty's got them. And in surgery, we have a collection called Enhanced Recovery After Surgery, shortened to ERAS, because medicine loves acronyms. Even if you are not familiar with enhanced recovery specifically, you are very likely practicing according to some of the principles. There are 20-something different guidelines related to different specialties and procedures, but they share some fundamentals that apply to care for any surgical patient. Here in Ontario, enhanced recovery was first formally implemented about a decade ago across a bunch of colorectal programs, led by a group from the University of Toronto under Dr. Robin McLeod. They published a series of quantitative and qualitative studies to report how it all worked out, and I was working on one of those original units, the one where Dr. McLeod herself practiced. And I can remember it, you know, the education, the order sets. It was a change, a big one. And there was definitely some skepticism, some reluctance. I will freely admit to having had some reservations myself. There were some elements that I was really unsure of, like having patients walk from the stretcher to the bed directly out of the recovery room, like after major abdominal surgery. But actually, turns out many people can do it, and now it's the routine. So yes, there was skepticism. But the promise was that if we did the ERAS things, then patients would do better, go home sooner. So we did the things. And we were collecting data that supported that promise in real time. So we kept doing the things, mostly. But I mean, we are always improving something or multiple things. So there is a lot of competition for our quality improvement attention. So time went by after those publications, and that same program, a few years later, was revisiting ERAS. A new updated guideline was published, and we wanted to see how to continue to build on that work. So I interviewed some of the people involved in that initial implementation. And then the pandemic slammed into us, the focus shifted, I left surgical nursing entirely, and those interviews sat in a file. But now I am back in surgery, in a different specialty, and we are, surprise, implementing an ERAS guideline for esophagectomy. So here I am, getting reacquainted with enhanced recovery, with a slightly different flavor, but same ERAS. And then just recently, Robin McLeod, that surgeon whose leadership brought enhanced recovery formally to Ontario, she died. But her impact on her patients directly and on surgical care more broadly certainly lives on, with a legacy that few are ever able to achieve. So, remembering Dr. McLeod and looking toward the future, today we're going to look at enhanced recovery, what it is, what it is not, and what we can learn from the years of work to bring its recommendations to life. And our guests today, each of whom worked closely with Dr. McLeod, are Emily Pearsall, Anand Govindarajan, and Stuart McCluskey. And like I said, we recorded just before the pandemic, which was a little bit ago. But since the focus is on the fundamentals of ERAS, which have not changed, and the most recent guideline for colorectal was published in 2018, before we sat down, the insights that they offer are just as applicable today. And I, over this process, have found quite a lot of value in what they offer and how to apply the principles in my own work and in understanding how they influence the functioning of the team in general. So I hope you do too. But with that being said, if there are any discrepancies that I may have overlooked, then that responsibility rests entirely with me. And now, our guests, starting with Emily Pearsall.
Oh, I love that we can hear the traffic in the rain outside too. That's pretty fun. So, Emily.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining me at the bedside.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's your title?
I am Manager of the Best Practice in Surgery, a quality initiative at the University of Toronto Department of Surgery. I was hired on to do some filing, fresh out of undergrad, for a woman named Dr. Robin McLeod. My master's was looking at the role of nurse champions, but my overall degree was in knowledge translation and health services research. And 10 years later, I am still working for Dr. McLeod, and I am now a manager of one of her research programs. Our focus is on developing and implementing locally tailored clinical practice guidelines. And enhanced recovery after surgery is about one of 10 guidelines that we've developed, but for sure our most popular guideline.
And Dr. Anand Govindarajan, general surgeon. Now, I hear your name pronounced a lot of different ways around the hospital. How do you say it?
Anand Govindarajan, yes.
Okay, where does that come from?
South India. Like most people who don't know, just put it together as two English words, like and, and so they'll sort of put it together. But it's actually in that language, there's no, that sort of that ah sound doesn't exist. Well, it's not doesn't exist, but so it's ah. So it's actually the emphasis on the first A.
Anand.
I just don't bother correcting anybody. So I'm a intestinal surgeon. I do predominantly cancer. I do colorectal cancer, advanced intestinal cancers.
And lastly, Dr. Stuart McCluskey, anesthesiologist.
Well, I'm a clinical researcher, and 80% of my time is spent clinically managing patients. The other 20% and maybe another 10% is for administration and things like that. But for the most part, I'm a clinician scientist. To start out with, I was a pharmacologist, so I studied drugs. And anesthesia has a lot of medications in it. And two things came together, and then I liked the role of anesthesia, the way anesthesia manages patients in the OR. But then I wanted to know what I did to my patient, how that affected them after surgery. I also wanted to be able to say to people with some reasoning, look, you know, I think this is too high risk, or this is a good surgery for you to have based on your ability to tolerate the surgery. So I became fascinated. It started as a drug interest, and then it sort of grew into this perioperative interest of both selecting patients and risk management, and then postoperative outcome management or outcome assessment. Straight up truth, I think it must be 9 years ago now, I was voluntold to help in the development of an enhanced recovery program around colorectal surgery run by Robin McLeod and Emily Pearsall. And I went to this thing and they asked me a very specific question. And I thought that the answer was not evident. So I thought about the answer to the question, and it was about fluid management, how to do it. And I had studied that already, and it was an interest of mine. That's why I was voluntold for this. And when I finally got the answer, I thought, wow, this is great. You know, I can take what I've done in terms of clinical research and apply it very quickly. And, you know, I fell in love with the process and the people and the interest and the focus. And it just sort of snowballed. And it sort of, it voluntold to, obviously, I should be doing this.
I think anyone who works in the surgical field has a sense of what ERAS is, but can you just describe it very basically? What is ERAS and where did it come from?
ERAS is a set of perioperative recommendations that, when used together, has been shown to decrease complications, decrease length of stay, and increase patient satisfaction. And it also is only really successful when nurses, anesthesiologists, surgeons, PTs, basically the whole healthcare team works together.
What it stands for would be enhanced recovery after surgery, which in some ways you would say it should be something everyone does, because enhancing the recovery is what you always want to do. But what it generally refers to is a set of principles or maneuvers or something that you do that is supported by evidence to improve recovery. The idea would be that it would eventually become the new normal. Everyone is ERAS, essentially, by default.
Okay. Enhancing recovery is about managing a patient that's undergoing surgery from the start to the finish, the discharge home to back to work. It's all of that, but, you know, there's no way one person can do it. So it just has to be, everyone has to think about all parts of the course in surgery. And if we work together and understand each other, then we can do it better. So, well, it means collaborative, caring, evidence-based management of patients.
It came from Europe about 20 years ago. It was a man named Henrik Kellett, and he cut surgery down, I think it started there, I think it was 10 days. And just at his one hospital, he brought it down to 2 days.
The length of stay.
The length of stay.
And patients were just as happy to leave after 2 days.
Just as happy to leave. Like, they didn't need to be in hospital for that long.
Those kind of results would definitely get people's attention. So in the early 2000s, based on this work, up in Northern Europe, the ERAS study group was formed. And they found that in spite of, as Emily described, this emerging evidence was saying regarding best practices and what could be achieved by following them, actual practice for colon surgery was different and quite variable. And if you've worked in a variety of places, this is not a shock. Traditions, practices, standards vary significantly from place to place, even from surgeon to surgeon within the same program sometimes. So the study group created a guideline. But even after some years of supporting, refining, and promoting it, they found that difference and variability in practice remained. Then in 2010, they formed the ERAS Society based in Stockholm, Sweden, and they began to focus more on the how to translate the growing evidence into practice.
So there's now the European ERAS Society actually has an implementation program that they offer around the world. McGill was the first Canadian institution to bring over the sort of European way of going about it. And we worked with McGill when we were developing our guideline. But we found it was actually quite important to tailor it to a local context, because a lot of things that are available in Europe like specific drugs are not necessarily available here, and how their hospital is set up is not at all how our hospitals are set up.
The influence of the environment and the way that we do things and the structure of relationships and communication, I can definitely see how you would need to tailor to that.
Yes.
How did you go about doing it?
So with all of our guidelines, we usually start with an audit of local practice to see if there is even a gap in care. So we focused on the University of Toronto affiliated hospitals, and we conducted a retrospective chart review in 2010 just to see what the current practice was. It was very interesting.
So you read through everybody's charting?
We hired summer students who read through 50 charts from each of the 8 hospitals. And we also conducted interviews with staff surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, administrators to find out if they were doing ERAS, what their thoughts were about it. And over half of the hospitals said that they were doing ERAS. And then when we saw the data, they were clearly not doing ERAS. So we determined that there was a gap in care. What we did is a systematic review of every single recommendation that had been published to date. So we reviewed the literature behind gum chewing, and we reviewed the literature behind bowel prep to determine what was evidence-based, what we could actually do here, and what the local experts would agree upon when there was missing evidence.
That sounds like a lot of work. It also sounds somewhat similar, although they didn't have to review all the data in that way, to what the thoracic program where I am now is in the process of doing to improve care for patients needing esophagectomy, which is a surgery with a tough recovery and high rates of complication. The different disciplines came together over a number of sessions and talked through adapting the existing ERAS guideline to the local context. And they served yummy food, which is always helpful if you want people to show up. So to help with the process, the recommendations are graded from weak through moderate to strong, which is a combined score based on the strength of the data and also on how much the panel of experts feels the benefits of doing something outweigh the associated risks. So, robust evidence base, low risk of harm, and high benefit makes a strong recommendation. But if there's sparse or somewhat dodgy data, less clear benefit and potential risks, that's a weak recommendation. And the components change over time. For example, now DVT prophylaxis is included in ERAS, where it was not originally. So obviously there is judgment involved in the process, but is it safe to say that the ERAS guidelines are overall well supported?
It is, yeah. So ERAS in general is. What is unclear, because the data isn't there yet, maybe ever, is what elements of it are more or less important. So we know in general, and even from the data from here, that the more compliant you are with the ERAS measures, it's associated with better outcomes. But I couldn't tell you, for example, that it was the chewing gum or it was the early walking that made the greatest difference, because no one has ever teased that out. We know as a package, it's better.
Which, you know, I've heard people describe as something frustrating about ERAS, but it also kind of makes sense. You know, all the many things that we do, they compound each other. It's hard to know the effects of each one. Maybe that's somewhere machine learning will offer insight in the future, but for now, we have to be satisfied with working with the whole package as best we can. And despite these questions, people are obviously enthusiastic about ERAS because it's spreading and being applied to more populations, including those with complex health needs, and adopted by more and more specialties.
It just makes sense from every single aspect of healthcare. Administrators love it because they are saving healthcare dollars, they're getting patients out of hospital quicker, so turning around beds, and then surgeons love it. Their patients are doing better, and patients love it because they feel part of their care. So it's a win-win-win. Everybody wins with ERAS. The toughest part about ERAS is implementing it. And that's what people have challenges with. And that's really the case with any sort of quality improvement project. Everyone is busy. And so to do something new is always going to be challenging.
Oh, for sure. Especially when that change has lots of different parts to it, like enhanced recovery does. So now let's turn to look more closely at those parts. And I've read quite a number of the guidelines now and the stated goal of each, and I'm reading directly from the colorectal guideline from 2018, is to reduce perioperative stress, maintain postoperative physiological function, and accelerate recovery after surgery. And achieving this requires a multimodal approach, and it is these multiple modes that make up the guidelines components. And as Anand said, when you put them together, they have a synergistic effect. As Stuart also noted, ERAS is structured to follow the person over time, addressing physical needs as well as informational and psychological ones. So there's an emphasis on counseling and information sharing, which rely on continuity and a planned, coordinated approach or pathway, whatever language you like, really, that centers the patient and family and their particular needs. So we all work together towards shared goals, with every discipline bringing their expertise so we can anticipate and meet the patient's needs as they go through, thereby reducing stress, enhancing recovery. That's the hope. So the guideline starts in pre-op, which is usually in a clinic, but sometimes pre-op is spent in hospital, and ERAS applies to these people as well. There are now guidelines for those requiring emergency surgery. And increasingly, there's consideration of prehabilitation, helping people get into the best shape possible, build up strength and reserve for the physical challenge of recovery from major surgery. This may be even more beneficial for those who are already deconditioned, which is actually many of our patients. So there is a lot of ongoing study and interest here.
Because most of, you know, ERAS addresses intra-op and post-op. The pre-op part is basically for 24 hours before. It talks about whether you should have carbohydrate drinks and stuff. But there's the prehab addresses the potential opportunity in the longer preoperative period to improve outcomes. Whereas everything else, all the ERAS stuff tends to be intra-op and post-op.
It's true, right? Like we see it in general. People who go into surgery better tend to recover better. So we can try to address physical needs so people go into surgery as well as possible. So ERAS suggests a number of different areas to focus on preoperatively, and one of those areas is nutrition. But if you have a problem with your GI tract or treatment that causes nausea and taste alteration, fatigue or food insecurity, any other health challenges or dental problems, etc., getting decent nutrition can be hard, but better nutrition is better. So trying to address nutritional needs early and support people and families pre-op to do so, it's only going to benefit them post-op. Also preventing or correcting anemia. Offering support to stop or reduce smoking and alcohol consumption, which is a big one, really, because both tobacco and alcohol use are risk factors for cancer, and cancer is often a reason for many of our surgeries. And honestly, going through withdrawal post-op certainly does not reduce stress for anyone involved. It is super difficult. So planning and mitigating that is really, really helpful. And around the time of surgery, lots of our patients do express a desire to change some habits. So having supports in place and planning for that gives us the opportunity to build on that internal sense of motivation. And also supporting movement or building strength. Maybe in the future, there will be more resources directed here. There's certainly ongoing study. And patients and families need information so they can understand what's happening, what's coming, and what they can expect when it's time to go home so they can plan and problem solve early. Even getting discharge supports coordinated beforehand, so there's more continuity, fewer unknowns. Here again, this requires a purposeful team approach.
Ideally, we know that setting their expectations ahead of time goes a long way towards compliance after the fact, even in terms of facilitating discharge. So a lot of it is preoperative counseling. So we do some of that in clinic. The pre-admission unit does some of that as well. I think that might be better because pre-admission unit is the same team no matter which surgeon is operating. And so the counseling will have a more consistent messaging to it. The other thing is that in pre-admissions, there's a lot of stuff going on, but they aren't, like, the sort of the shock that they need surgery is over. And so whereas I feel in clinics sometimes, they aren't processing the post-operative stuff as much. because they're processing the complications you've told them they could have. They're processing the risks and benefits and the surgery. And you tell them, oh, you're going to be chewing gum, you're going to be going home in 3 days or whatnot. I don't find that they process it that well, whereas in PAU, I think there's some of that overwhelming stuff has gone over, and they know I'm preparing for surgery. I'm going to see the anesthetist to prepare for surgery. I'm going to see the pharmacist to prepare for surgery. I'm going to see the nurse who's going to tell me about my expectations after surgery. And I think sometimes that's probably the better place to do it. So at the end of the day, it's a combo. It's education pre by us, pre by the PAU nurses, post-op by us and the nursing team and the dietetics team and the allied health team as well. It's sort of continuous, as you say.
I think that's a really good point. You certainly see that post-op when you encounter someone who seems to have really missed something very important that was certainly communicated to them preoperatively. But just because we tell somebody something doesn't mean that they absorb and retain it. Timing and repetition, be it verbally, written, multimedia, it's really important, which reinforces the need to co-design our processes with patients and families as much as possible to make sure that they are meeting their needs.
Well, when we see patients preoperatively here, their medical history is reviewed by a nurse first. So I review those, okay, and I do risk assessments. There's several scores that we employ, and it's actually calculated for us, so that's fine. And I read that, and I make sure I'm aware of that. And then I make sure I know what the nurse has been telling the patient. And I also make sure I know what the surgeon's been telling the patient. The other person, as I ask, is often the patient, because that's the center of all this, right? This is just an easy way for us to work together, basically. But the patient, I ask them what they've been told. My job when I see a patient in the preoperative clinic, a lot of it is assessing or reassessing the patient, but bringing everything together and making sure the patient understands it. I will sit there and say, for example, what medications are you going to take on the day of surgery? And they'll say, it's on that piece of paper. And I'll say, well, can you get the piece of paper out? So we know, right? Probably the most important thing is, how many days do you think you're going to stay in hospital? And then they'll tell me 4 or 5 or 10, and I'll say, okay, is that what you got from the surgeon? No, that's just what I assumed, right? So you have to make sure those problems are resolved first.
The only thing I would include is there's a lot of responsibility and expectations on the patients and their sort of caregivers to also really be part of their care. And the one thing that we found, we interviewed patients at the end of our sort of implementation efforts, and they said that ERAS only works if all the messaging is the same. So it is essential that the messaging is the same and that everybody is on the same page, which requires a lot of education for the staff as well as for the patients. Because even imagine for pre-op fast, your surgeon says to you, I want you to have a sugary drink 2 hours before surgery. And then the pre-op nurse calls you and says NPO at midnight. And then you show up there and the nurse there has absolutely no idea that you should be getting Tylenol and can have Gatorade. So when you're sitting there with it in your hand, your surgery then becomes delayed. That's absolutely horrible.
Oh, it really is. Yeah. Those miscommunications leading to delays do certainly happen, both in procedures and diagnostics, much more than they should. Often related to eating medications haven't been given or not, or like anticoagulation status. And they're really, really frustrating and wasteful. But communication in general is challenging, and consistent standards do go some way toward helping with that, I think. So that is the pre-op stuff, optimizing physical state, providing information so patients and families can have a sense of what to expect, and so that we have a sense of what to expect, or any challenges that we might foresee so that we can all plan a bit better. Which brings us now to the day of surgery, where, as Anand says, the recommendations really start to pick up. As Emily alluded to there, enhanced recovery recommends avoiding a prolonged pre-op fast, which remains inconsistently applied even up to this time. Solids up to 6 hours before, clear carbohydrate-rich liquids up to 2 hours before, unless, of course, that does not make any sense at all, if you have an obstruction or delayed gastric emptying, in which case those instructions need to be tailored to that patient specifically. prolonged fasting is a stressor, and it seems to exacerbate post-op insulin resistance, which we will talk about more later. It can lead to dehydration. It's unpleasant, especially in today's reality of ORs being canceled or bumped. It's tough on people. Also, ERAS says less bowel prep. Hallelujah. Nobody likes a bowel prep. Again, it can cause dehydration, sleep deprivation, electrolyte imbalance. The number of times I've seen someone fall or almost fall during a bowel prep, it's just a shit time. And then just before surgery, prophylactic antibiotics and skin preps to reduce surgical site infections and pre-op DVT prophylaxis. So now, the patient is prepped and it's time to go through to the OR. And ERAS has recommendations for the surgeon, depending on what they're doing, related to choice of surgical approach, recommending minimally invasive when possible. It's just so amazing, these major surgeries being done through these tiny little incisions and using fewer drains, which I love. I mean, any drain or tube carries risks, infection, local trauma. They get tugged all the time. They impede movement. They cause pain. They require skilled management. They leak. When it comes to tubes in general, ERAS says less is more. But, I mean, obviously they're valuable tools and sometimes they're needed. But ERAS says that when they are used, pull them out sooner. There are also lots of recommendations for the anesthesiologist around drugs and ventilation, using warming devices to avoid hypothermia and maintain a normal body temperature throughout the operation. So, Stuart, what are some of the main changes that you've seen in your practice as a result of enhanced recovery as an anesthesiologist?
Pain management's one. We do things like lidocaine infusions, ketamine infusions, magnesium sulfate administration. We try not to give long-acting narcotic, and we've already given them preoperative medications like the Celebrexes and gabapentins. We've all considered all those things. So it's specific medications that we've added, and we've added them based on how we think they'll tolerate that. Much more than they were in the past, we've taken them off of protocols and said, what does this patient need? So we've made it patient-specific. The best example and my sort of favorite area is fluid therapy. So we used to give fluid based on a protocol that was written by don't know who, but it gave a lot of fluid, and it didn't necessarily have to. So we give fluid because we know we're trying to manage hemodynamics. We give fluid because we have to give medications that are intravenous. So we give it for those two reasons. But we titrate it to an effect so that now, and we have more and more tools that help us give a precision to that treatment. It's really important that people recognize that a drug identification number at the top of every bag of normal saline, Ringer's lactate, or plasmolite, whatever it is, that means that it's a drug and it should be treated that way, not just as something that can flow in because you know you forgot the spigot. So it's detailed attention to what the patient's response is. The ventilation is the same. All those things, some of them are not in enhanced recovery, many of them are, but they're all part of improving patient care and just being more responsive to that patient rather than taking some protocol off the shelf and applying it to everyone, because we know that different procedures have different bowel preps and preoperative management, all kind, and they're just different people, different patients, different surgeries.
Can you just describe, like, when you get the post-op, the operative report, you see a lot of fluid goes in a short period of time. What is physiologically happening that requires extra fluid during surgery?
Well, it's all being reevaluated, right? So we're trying to manage the numbers that we see on our screen. So we're managing the hemodynamics in terms of heart rate and blood pressure. We don't want to put a stress on this patient, so we don't want tachycardia if we can avoid it. We don't want the blood pressure to go too low because organ perfusion is dependent on it. So we have to do things that are compensating for other things that we do. So the amount of anesthetic we give cuts off the sympathetic nervous system, so you get hypotension. So you can either give them fluid, which means you preload the heart, you give more fluid to the heart so it starts to work better, its cardiac output increases, Or you say, well, let's just counteract the effects of the anesthetic, we'll vasoconstrict them. So the idea of using vasoconstrictors peripherally is new and it should be used probably a lot more. But there's evidence to show that they do better. Like if you realize that you're causing a sympathectomy and you add sympathetically active drugs, it's a good thing. And you can titrate, decide whether is it fluid this patient needs or is it vasopressors or vasoactive agents or inotropes. And that way the patient's going to do better.
Yeah, I think as Stuart predicts, since we spoke, this is increasingly happening. I don't work in the OR, but in the report that I receive and in the post-anesthesia unit, I'm seeing more use of medications like norepinephrine, even in some cases in the post-op period, which is where we will turn our attention now. So after the operation, the patient moves into the recovery room, where it is time to wake up. And hopefully, if we do our job correctly, they will then have a nap. And the goal from here is functional recovery. And this is where the patient themselves plays a bigger role. So, as mentioned, the goal is to mitigate the stress response to surgery. To try to put some of this into context, let's look at what that response is. And I'm drawing on a paper from the ERAS Society website that I've linked to in the show notes if you want to check it out. It is open access. Surgery is a big stress, eliciting an inflammatory, neurohormonal, and immune response at the site of injury and systemically, with effects on the other organ systems. The more stressful the surgery, the more significant the response. We see that for sure. Reduce the stress, reduce the response. And that response is broad because the stressors are broad. They include anxiety, the anesthetic itself, tissue damage, bleeding, hypothermia, fluid shifts, all of which we're trying to avoid, hypoxia, pain, bed rest, ileus, cognitive disturbances, starvation. All of these things are stressors. And this is also where pre-existing health conditions can certainly aggravate things. The response is mediated by hormones, cytokines, neurotransmitters that cause an inflammatory state, the body trying to heal, with effects on the systems and organs that control homeostasis, metabolism, and circulation, all of which we see happening in our patients. For example, younger women may menstruate directly after surgery, right? It just seems totally unfair, actually, like you're not already uncomfortable enough. And sometimes it's very surprising, you know, they need some reassurance that, oh yeah, this sometimes is just a response to surgery. And you have a metabolic response, which alters protein and glucose metabolism. The body starts breaking down protein stores. We know this. We see it reflected in their labs. Patients with a long stay or complicated recovery, they lose lean muscle with the effect that it is harder to mobilize, harder to heal. They may have lowered immunity. And the patient has to work hard to build that back up. There's also a period of insulin resistance right after surgery. We see this too, that rise in blood sugars post-op that we find ourselves chasing so often, especially in our patients who have diabetes. Surgery causes a catabolic state, and we try to keep it brief so that it serves its function, and then the patient returns to a more normal metabolism. Protein depletion and prolonged hyperglycemia are strongly associated with poorer outcomes, like higher rates of mortality, a longer length of stay, or infection. This is the foundation behind avoiding prolonged fasting. So promoting eating as soon as possible after surgery, avoiding that pre-op fast, and using epidurals and nerve blocks. They block the nerve impulses, they provide comfort, and also those nerve impulses transmitting pain, you know, they contribute to the systemic response. And also us doing a good job of managing blood sugars. The circulatory system definitely is impacted and has a response. There is stress on the heart. We see this with the rise of troponin after surgery, even when that patient may not have any symptoms of ischemia. If we monitor it consistently, we may see a troponin rise in the days afterward. And the increased risk of developing arrhythmias, be it sinus tachycardia or bradycardia, PVCs, or that old classic post-op atrial fibrillation. And effects on homeostasis. There are changes in vascular permeability and tone, tending toward leaky. All of the edema and the peripheral puffiness that we see. The body retains salt and fluid to maintain homeostasis. There may be electrolyte abnormalities and a period of hypercoagulability, hence the recommendation of DVT prophylaxis. body temperature can be wonky, low initially. People tend to run cold during and directly after surgery, and then you might see a low-grade fever a bit later. The gut responds, and generally not happily. They may have an ileus, especially when it has been directly manipulated, or there is a large inflammatory response or fluid overload. The respiratory system with atelectasis, respiratory depression. Sometimes you'll see pleural effusions, which is why we are always so focused on deep breathing, early ambulation, coughing, and good positioning. People experience cognitive changes, definitely. It may be delirium or cognitive dysfunction in the post-op period. It definitely happens, especially with older people or people who are very sick. People find it difficult to concentrate. Think about all the books that people bring in that just end up sitting there on the bedside table unread. And pain, the response to tissue damage. If it's not controlled, it can exacerbate all of the above and interfere with recovery. So managing pain is a big priority right from the get-go. There are often multiple contributors to the experience of pain, different types of pain and their associated pathways, and thus different ways to manage it, which ERAS describes as a multimodal approach. And of course, pain and nausea are buddies, so they need to be considered together. Preventing nausea and vomiting is a large tenet of enhanced recovery. And because pain is a subjective experience, it relies on preparation and inclusion of the patient.
We'll not only talk about pain management before surgery, during surgery, and after surgery, but I'll ask them this straightforward question. Do you think you're going to have pain? Or I'll tell them, you know this is going to hurt. Because there are some people, many people just think I'm a bit foolish, you know, and obviously they know surgery is going to hurt. But there are a few who go, you know, really? I thought you had pain medicine for that. So the big thing in pain management to me has been developed by Hans Clark and his group here, and not really developed by them, sort of promoted by them, making sure patients understand it's going to hurt. Pain medicine doesn't take away the pain. It dulls it and allows you to do things, and we're going to manage the pain not for pain's sake, but for functional state. So we make sure that the people know that taking a big breath is important, and if it hurts so much they can't do that, that's something we'll fix. And that we're going to be there, not only immediately interoperatively or postoperatively, but all along the stage. Anesthesia in my department have people that will come anytime. And then there's also the attending nurses who know just as much as we do and can help clarify things. But when they learn about it after surgery, first of all, if they're surprised that it hurts, it's going to hurt a lot more. If they know it's going to hurt, then it seems like this is not such a surprise and not as dramatic.
I think that's really true about the importance of preparation. And it has to be all done in conjunction with managing nausea. So being proactive in collaboration with others, especially our physician colleagues, making a plan that includes the patient, builds their knowledge and skills for discharge, using all the various drugs, the doses and routes. Enhanced recovery really supports the use of epidurals and nerve blocks, using opioids safely and compassionately, promoting breathing, movement, proper positioning, using cold, heat, and distraction, really using all of the different modalities and understanding how they all work together while minimizing their side effects, rather than just relying on one method as we may have in the past, with the goal being specific to that patient's functional state.
And some of it requires, I think, a change in mindset, because many aspects of ERAS were a change from what traditionally might have been done. For example, fluids. In the past, fluids were never seen as bad. More fluids was better in that you don't ever want a patient to be dry. But it became obvious over time that that wasn't necessarily true. Dry was bad, but wet was bad too. Yeah. So you wanted them in the middle, just right. And so that was a bit of a change. You don't bolus people a liter just because their urine output is slightly low. You know, you be more judicious about it. Maybe if the urine output is a little low, but their blood pressure and everything's okay, maybe you accept that. No one needs to get alarmed over it. Removing Foley catheters with epidurals in place. That's a massive change from what we used to do, where if the epidural is in, Foley stays in. But we know now that in most patients, you can take the Foley out with the epidural in place. Retention rates are not that high. Feeding's the same. Traditionally, NPO, wait for gas, then clear fluids, and then food. But ERAS said just feed them. Just give them whatever they want. Let them decide by themselves. And that's a change. Surgical team has to accept that change. And this coaching that's involved. The patients, like you said, if in the previous time, if they had been NPO, and now suddenly you tell them they can eat on day one, they start questioning it. The nursing team has to accept it as well, because they interact with the patients far more in terms of time than we do. And so I think there's some sort of sea changes that happened that, to be honest, they go back and forth. I find even now, for example, the epidural, I find there are some people who won't take the Foley yet. Oh, the epidural's in. Well, it's okay, actually. So,
yes, to this day, the indications for placement and timing around removal of the Foley catheter remain a hot topic. And that is all I will say about that. The same can be said for post-op eating. There is still a lot of variability in terms of how patient-led that process truly is. It's especially difficult for our patients with diabetes who do not want juice or jello, the typical clear fluids. And different people and cultures have different preferences for illness food. I mean, I've seen everything from the plainest of congees as their sort of first meal to flaming red fish in hot pepper soup and vomiting. Oh God, vomiting, that would be so bad. But it was not her first surgery. She took it slow and she did just fine.
Because, you know, the one thing everyone forgets about early feeding, we say DAT, but no one actually thinks about what the AT is. It's as tolerated. And I tell my residents all the time, you know, like when you're telling them DAT, you got to tell them that they don't need what's on the tray. They can eat nothing. They can eat a crumb. They can eat the whole tray if they feel like it. But if you don't tell them, I guarantee you, they all think that for their health, they need to eat that tray in full.
Yes. Counseling is really important. Going slowly, listening to the body's cues. I usually encourage people to eat a bit, wait a bit, see how you feel. Feeling hunger is a good sign. And as Anand mentioned, finding that sweet spot between too wet and too dry can be tricky as well. ERAS talks about goal-directed fluid management. So what does that mean?
Every single patient should have goal-directed fluid therapy. I don't care if they're having a toenail clipped or they're having a thoracoabdominal aneurysm. Everyone should be undergoing goal-directed fluid therapy, goal-directed transfusion therapy, goal-directed coagulation management. All of it should be goal-directed. And actually, it was the very specific question they asked me when I started this enhanced recovery program with Robin. He says, how can you fluid restrict our patients? And I said, well, I don't know. She said, well, what about 1,500 mils? I said, well, I don't think that's right for everyone. But we came up with an idea of goal-directed fluid therapy. So I didn't make the name up, but the idea is that every single patient has enough objective material to be able to use as a goal. So if you have a patient undergoing an appendectomy and you have a non-invasive blood pressure cuff and you have a pulse oximeter, then the goals would be to avoid hypotension, because we think hypotension is bad, and to avoid tachycardia, because tachycardia means there's a stress. So the goals are to keep those two parameters within normal, and the pulse oximetry and the other data that we have available will help too. But if you're undergoing cardiac surgery or liver transplant surgery and you have a cardiac output monitor in, if it's a PA catheter, an arterial waveform device, those things can make it more precise. So we can say, this time the goal is going to be not just blood pressure, because we know that's not the only parameter. Let's look at stroke volume. So how well is the heart pushing blood out? So you can make goal-directed fluid therapy hit those targets, but the target's going to be different. You know, when I do small procedures in clinics outside of the main hospital here, even though they're minor, there's some evidence that if they don't get a liter of fluid in the perioperative period, then they increase the risk of nausea and vomiting and complications in simple procedures. So, and 1 liter of fluid isn't a lot when you consider there's an average-sized person's 42 liters. So that would be my goal, to maintain blood pressure and to get roughly 800 to 1,000 mils in. It's a protocol, and I understand I'm sort of contradicting myself, but I don't have any other parameters to work by, so that's the goal there. And as I said, the goal might be stroke volume in other cases, or heart rate, or, you know, we can even put a transesophageal echocardiogram down to make sure that the left and right heart are filling adequately. So the goal is always different, and it just has to be a goal, and there's no giving fluid because anymore.
Beautifully said. I think it sounds like it's a lifelong learning kind of thing. You just continue to refine and practice and get better at managing fluids with patients.
You hope so, you know, and then you find out that, my gosh, it didn't work this time.
Yeah.
You know, so you try and figure out why, and you go back, and it's always different, but I'm still following the goals, right? Even if I make a mistake, give too much fluid in one case, or over-transfuse, those goals, if I missed my goal, I just try and figure out why. So it's not, yeah, it's lifelong learning, I guess, but it's more just managing patients practically and spending my time focused on the patient. And I mean, that's our primary monitor is the patient. So whether it's if you have a blood pressure cuff on an arterial line, it doesn't matter. That's the primary goal is the patient. It's one of the big deficits left in enhanced recovery is that if I have a patient in after surgery, immediately after surgery, they go to the recovery room and I'm still able to influence it. And with people like you, I can say, okay, don't give this patient fluid, we'll give them a little bit of inotrope until they wake up. We can work on this, you know, not just sort of give fluid. That was just the response. You probably remember, you know, patient's hypotension, squeeze in fluid, give more fluid. Just didn't think about it. But now we think about it. And now the patient hemodynamically is relatively stable. They go to the step down or intermediate care or the floor. And then unfortunately we kind of lose touch, right? But I'm convinced that's the period that's, you know, if I'm half attentive, that's in the OR, there's probably 100 times more attention than a patient can receive when they're in the rooms. You know, they just don't get managed. People, you know,
There are many challenges there. That's
tons.
My world.
Yeah, but they need it.
They do.
They need it. And that's maybe where the real focus should start to be. And, you know, just a simple thing, in most floors here, even in a step down or level 2 ICU care, I can't run inotropes. So one of the treatments is missing. I just have to give fluids, and that's all the attending surgeon or the attending resident can do is give fluids to change blood pressure or respond to reduced urine output, those kind of things. So that's probably the next area for our management. But we know that about 80% of their fluid is given interoperatively anyhow, particularly maybe even higher than that on the first day. And then after that, if you're following enhanced recovery and they're on track, then they should have those intravenouses removed and the patient starts to eat and drink as soon as possible. But there's a potential for prolonged intravenous infusions, and that's where we should be involved much more. Keeping the principle of let's get rid of this stuff as soon as possible.
Yes.
And let the patient take over physiologically, that's still the attention they need. It doesn't take a lot of effort to do it, but, you know, it's that period where other groups have to start paying attention. You know, getting the patient out of bed, ambulating them, making them move, making sure the patient's aware of that preoperatively and post-op. But yeah, you got to get them moving so that there's a redistribution of fluids comes back again. You know, they used to talk about 3 days before you mobilize fluid from all these spaces, but you know, if you're moving and active, you know, things start to get better. It's hard.
Some people, yeah, I notice it happens much faster than that. If they're up, they're deep breathing, they're moving around.
Yeah.
So many times that actually, you may look at a patient who's a bit tachycardic, they're just waking up, their urine output's a little low. Historically, we may have said, let's bolus them some fluid on rounds at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Now we might say, actually, let's just get them up.
Yeah.
Get them up, get them moving, and it amazingly shifts that fluid a bit more. They diurese, and their vitals improve.
Yeah,
give them a little pain management.
Yeah.
Certainly in my own observation.
Yeah.
What I'd love to see is the hallways full of patients. I would love to see the hall. I'd love to not be able to round into rooms because the patient is not there, because they're walking, or they're sitting, or they're eating their dinner somewhere other than their bed. I'd love to see that. In fact, I've heard of places like that where their hallways are full of people and they have dining rooms because you can't eat your food in your bed. Maybe that would be better. So I would love to see the hallways full of patients, but I think there's infection control reasons why you can't actually do something like that. But that's sort of a logistical thing that I think I would love to see, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I would love to see that too. I think we all would, but that is not the reality. There are lots of barriers to mobility, including the environment, lack of available personnel, factors related to the person themselves. But we try. Even though it is not easy, especially in those early days right after surgery, because we know that it is so important, physically and mentally for the person. And of course, mobilization relies on all the other elements of enhanced recovery, like pain control, nutrition, hydration, getting rid of all those lines early, managing nausea, smaller incisions, patient and family involvement, etc., all of which rely in turn on interprofessional collaboration and teamwork.
100%. So when we implemented it, there was a massive committee, and the committee had representatives from all the disciplines that interact with patients. From on the physician side, there was anesthetists, surgeons. On the allied health side, there was nurses, physios, occupational therapy, dietitian. They were all on it because all of them were affected by at least one of the recommendations. So the interprofessional, the interdisciplinary part of it is huge. Everyone has to believe in it, maybe is probably the best way to put it, because there is a role for everybody in it. Even the early mobility, it often will fall on nursing, but it may fall on physio, and the authorization falls on the surgical team. Something like the early feeding, the surgical team authorizes it, but the counseling that goes with it and the coaching in some ways goes to the nursing team and the dietetics team. So there's a huge interprofessional aspect of it. It's a team thing for sure.
So that takes us through most of the fundamental elements of post-op care that are generalizable across procedures. And the last part is evaluation, measuring compliance with the recommendations. And what I've noticed is a trend where the compliance tends to be lower in the post-operative phase than the others. Do you have a sense of why that might be the case?
Yeah, it's because every patient is different. When we collect data on all patients undergoing elective colorectal surgery. And so the 92-year-old woman who cannot mobilize is included in that data, although she's not going to meet those recommendations. And also with the post-op sort of recommendations is that there are so many cooks in the kitchen, yeah. Right? You have surgeons, you have residents, you have nurses, you have pain team, you have anesthesiologists, you have PT, you have dietitians, patients, their families, their caregivers. There are so many reasons why that's where the compliance goes down. But the fact that it has shown to really make such a difference just means that we need to do better. And we need to come up with better or different strategies of how to really ensure that those recommendations are being followed when they can be followed. One of the biggest sort of enablers that we found is we did a lot of audit and feedback. So we were prospectively collecting data on ERAS patients and then feeding it back to the centers. So as a nurse, you would have a lot of questions. Like, I don't want my patient to be vomiting or feeling nauseous. So I'm going to continue to say, don't eat until post-op day 2, let's say. But then when you show the data that the patients are eating on post-op day 1, they're going home on post-op day 3, and they're not coming back to hospital, and they're doing great, then all of a sudden, there's no more pushback. Because as a nurse, you just want your patient to be okay. So when you can see that not only are they okay, but they're actually thriving, then there's no more pushback.
We did a paper, with Robin did a paper, looking at compliance and benefit. Very well-received paper, and it showed the more things you did of the enhanced recovery program, the better the patient did, the more likely they would get out of the hospital early. That's nice, but it doesn't ask the right question. Did you consider this treatment? And if so, did you do it? Or did you reject it? Gabapentin is probably the best example. Gabapentin, the evidence is depends how you read it and depends what outcome you look at. But there are some people, if you give them gabapentin, you know, they already come in somnolent or sleepy, or they have liver failure. Giving them gabapentin may just make things worse. So you consider it and you don't do it. To me, that is still a tick mark. You considered that component of the enhanced recovery program. But if you look at it in hindsight, it will say, no, you didn't get gabapentin, therefore you didn't do it.
You can still be applying these principles even though you didn't do the tick mark. This. It's directing your thinking in the way that you care for your patients.
Exactly. And that's the thing that's hard to record, really hard to record.
Really hard.
But we know we're stressing everyone out with all these questions we're asking them already, so we have to get it a little tighter somehow. I'm not sure how.
Stressing who out?
All the participants, all people along the way. You know, did I do this, did I do that? They're checking this, they're checking that. No, that's not what we're trying to do.
The auditing, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, comes back, Stuart, why didn't you give gabapentin to these 10 people? Okay. I didn't think it was indicated here, and these days I didn't have enough time, so I have to justify why I didn't. That's what we don't want to do, but somehow we need to come up with a process where instead of saying yes to gabapentin, we did it, it's no to gabapentin. Because we're trying to calculate it in hindsight, we need a simple way of doing it. So if it says gabapentin, yes, no, and we go no, that's what's considered.
It's also a charting issue. A lot of times we don't necessarily...
Oh, it's always a charting issue.
Well, I'm doing a retrospective chart review. I can tell you there are a lot of charting issues.
You poor thing. You poor thing.
I know. Woe is me. But that is a problem because you don't necessarily know if patients are sitting up to have their meals. That's never going to be charted. I've never once seen that in a chart. They do, they'll say a patient ambulated. We're not sure what that means. Did they dangle? Did they do a lap? Nobody really knows. So there's still lots of work to be done.
I can only imagine how difficult it would be to use our documentation to measure how well the guidelines are being applied. You know, given the complex health challenges that many of our patients face, and the goal of moving beyond this binary of people being either ERAS or not.
So part of it, I think, is to appreciate that ERAS applies to everybody. It's not meant for the straightforward colorectal procedure. It literally, because it's just a set of principles to enhance care.
It was validated in that population.
It's been applied in many others. It's been applied to hepatobiliary patients. It's been applied to gastrectomies. It's been applied everywhere, basically. Because at the end of the day, so even a complex patient, like say you have an exenteration. That's probably the ultimate one, or exenteration with a sacrectomy and a flap. Ambulating them is hard. But we try. And because we know ambulation matters, we just don't associate it with ERAS, even though it is one of the ERAS things. They may have an NG tube. Okay, so that principle doesn't apply. They may need their they don't have Foley, they have a conduit, but suppose they have some bladder repair. They may need their Foley longer. Okay, but the principle is take it out as early as possible. It's not take it out in 24 hours. It's just for colons, take it out in 24 hours. But maybe for you, as early as possible is 7 days. No problem. That's still part of ERAS. So I think part of it is just accepting that ERAS isn't something special. It's just, this is what the data says. And there are elements of it that apply to everybody. Because, you know, I think one of the... But again, everyone remembers the negative experience, right? Everyone remembers the time that something was done as part of ERAS that was... They did on autopilot, essentially, even though... Because they didn't think it through, right? And so then they're like, oh, you know, ERAS. But that's one element of it in one patient that should never have been done. And at the end of the day, you know, I honestly think ERAS is just basically like everything else we do, which is implementing best practice, whatever the evidence says. ERAS is just a series of best practices. That's literally all it is. And like every other guideline, it's not meant to be used without thinking. It is a guideline and a principle that needs to be individualized to your patient. Maybe I'll do this, 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 and this, but I'm not going to do this part of it because of this reason. Maybe I'm not going to take their Foley out on day one because they have a huge prostate. They're definitely going to retention. I'm going to let the Flomax settle in for a little bit longer. So I think people adopted it as dogma, and it needs to be done exactly, and it's all or nothing. If it fails, so what? If it fails, it's like anything, right? If an NG comes out and a normal patient goes back in, that's not failure. That's just, it happened. 10-15% of cases will go back in, right? So yeah. I think it's how you view it. Is it, if you view it as different than what we do regularly, which is just a collection of best practices, then you see it as something. But if it's just literally what we do in every other aspect of our care, we just don't put a name on it.
I've seen a lot of reference to this being a complex intervention,
yes.
And that rings very true with me and my experience. And I understand that's what you've been finding too.
Yes, for sure. That's why ERAS requires such active implementation. It's not the same as just implementing even, let's say, 3 recommendations, because ERAS usually has like 15 to 20 recommendations that actually have to all be implemented together.
On the foundation of inclusion of patients and families
yes.
and education. And, you know,
yes.
Just those little things.
No problem.
Just those
no problem.
Things.
Just get all healthcare team members in the room at the same time on the same page.
No problem.
Easy peasy.
Yeah. But we're doing it.
We are doing it.
Like we're actually incrementally making improvements, right?
Oh, yeah. And what we actually found is not only did the hospitals love it, but they just started implementing it across different surgical specialties. They just kept expanding ERAS because it was working so well.
It's the same nurses a lot of the time.
Yep.
In those post-operative populations.
Same anesthesiologists, too. Yeah,
exactly. Same PTs, same dietitians for a lot of those patients.
Yep, same pre-op nurses. So it's so much easier to just have everyone drink a sugary drink 2 hours before surgery rather than having a little note to just say elective colorectal surgical patients, because that is actually best evidence for almost every single surgical patient. And that evidence is very old. We're talking 1990s.
Yeah, wow.
We're all creatures of habit, and it's very hard to change that habit. So I don't know, to be honest, it happens with any intervention. There's always a peak during the study, and slowly drifts back. Our residents are good because they rotate through all sorts of places, and eventually, you know, the whole practice everywhere changes. And so they come in not having a different idea. So for the residents, taking Foley's out is now normal because everywhere they go, they do that. Whereas when we started, they would go to some places where you would, some places where you wouldn't. They wouldn't know what we do. They would be afraid to do something. They would be afraid to make a mistake. And so I think eventually, as things just become the new normal, it'll become the new normal. But there are still places there aren't. And I don't know what is taught in nursing school, just like I don't know what's taught in medical school about any of this. So it's the change factor that's, I think, really, really hard.
Yeah.
And maintaining the change.
Oh, true that. Now, Emily, you did a qualitative study and published a qualitative study looking at the process of implementation and people's sort of feelings with that. Can you describe that for us?
Oh, we interviewed staff before implementation to determine barriers and then after implementation to discuss sustainability and whether ERAS was actually working at their center, what could be done more, differently, better. We interviewed administrators, nurses, dietitians, physiotherapists, absolutely everybody who was part of the ERAS team. We tried to get the whole picture.
And what did you find?
We found that people do love ERAS, and when it works very well. But there are always going to be late adopters, and that doesn't necessarily mean that ERAS is not going to work. ERAS works best with a top-down and bottom-up approach. You cannot just have it one way.
Probably the main lesson I learned from the ERAS was how tough it is to implement things. And sometimes it requires not a policy change, but it requires like infrastructure change almost. I think, you know, for the early mobilization, one of the floors, I think, some sort of mobility rounds. And so they would all go around at a certain hour or something and get everyone out of bed. And that worked, I think. I don't know if they still do it. There's a local aspect of it where the local culture has to come up with how to implement some sort of principle. And that is, I think, has to be a grassroots thing. And so I think sometimes, I don't know if it's re-education, ongoing education.
I think there's definitely a role for that.
I think so. It's hard. It's how do you do it, right? And also personnel changes. Like, yep. There's so much changeover, agency nurses, people leave, new people come. They may have come from places where they weren't doing this and used to do what the old way, if you want to call it that. And then there's no mechanism to say, hey, this is how we do things.
In addition to these challenges around changing standards and systems of care, are challenges around communication and coordination.
Everyone who needs to communicate is not in the same place at the same time that often. Sometimes face-to-face is lost given how busy everyone is and all the different places everyone is pulled. And I think the busyness affects the ability to do everything that is ideal. So, you know, your counseling sessions with the patients are shorter than ideal perhaps because you have somewhere else to be. Mobility probably would be improved if you had more time to force them out of bed.
That's right.
The surgical team comes by before shift change typically. Right. There may be there's that handover now, I think, but it's not always done, and sometimes done by maybe a really junior person. The team may be hard to reach in the day if they're in the operating room. They can always be reached for emergencies, but you know the question is, what is it? Emergency? Probably not. The staff are we just come on rounds and we're emailable and people know where we work, but they don't want to disturb us. And so sometimes I find that there's a lot of communication by chart or communication, but and sometimes it's just easier just to talk to someone in person and say what, and some of the rounds we have, like palliative care rounds, that's great because everyone's there and you can hash out all the problems rather than someone sending an email and having to read the note and this and that. I think having the PAs around is great because part of their mandate is to talk to patients. You guys are busy. You know, sometimes someone calls in sick or whatnot, suddenly you have more patients, which means you can spend less time with anyone, any one person. And some of it is resources. You know, every place is stretched. No one is twiddling their thumbs thinking, oh, I'm doing nothing. Maybe I'll counsel someone right now, right? And everyone's got too many things to do. It's what do I do first? And what do I do last? And I think sometimes things like counseling go last because meds have to be given or an NG has to be placed. The medical stuff comes first and counseling is viewed as it can wait or, okay, if I don't do it today, it's okay because I have other things that are more critical. And that there's no way around that. It's just it is what it is, right? Unless there are ways to make it more efficient.
These challenges and barriers, they resonate, and they probably will with you too. Implementing change or improvements they're tough, even when it's just one person, let alone a whole diverse group operating within a complex system. Which really brings us back to that core principle that quality exists in a dynamic and is dependent on factors related to the professionals involved, their knowledge, skills, beliefs, the existing culture we work in, and how well they communicate or are enabled to communicate and work together. Factors related to the patient themselves, their knowledge, supports, engagement, how well they are going in, and just luck. I mean, complications happen. Sometimes when you least expect them, it's just the reality. And of course, factors related to the system. Resources like staffing levels, education, training, whether data is being collected, maybe through a program like NISQIP, the quality of that data and how it's fed back to the clinicians in a meaningful way, how well services are integrated or not, as the case may be. And like Anand says, maybe there are ways to increase efficiency. Some identified in the literature, like order sets or having designated champions from different disciplines who have social capital and influence, and developing materials for the patients and families to take some of the pressure off of us, the stretched clinicians, to do it all, you know, in real time.
And originally, did you not have patients doing journaling? Is that part of what they yeah. first round did? Did they do it?
They did it, and they loved it.
Oh, really?
Our feedback from patients, they thanked us for creating the booklet because they were meant to get it when they consented for surgery. So they went home with this booklet to say, this is your surgical journey, and this is what we expect from you. We want you up. We want you to be eating. You can bring in cereal from home or bread, whatever you want. And these are your different pain options. So they were aware of what was going to go on. And then after surgery, they would sit there beside their bed and check off whether they walked. And it was a good reminder and that they could walk and if they ate. And that worked very well for patients. Some hospitals are still using it. They may or may not be collecting that data, but regardless, patients really liked it because they felt like they were part of it. And then they could also say to the nurses, excuse me, I think I'm supposed to get up and walk today. And it was a great reminder.
Oh yes, those patients. Thanks, Emily. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
For the eighth time, really. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, but honestly, I'll take that motivation over reluctance any day. I am a big supporter of all written or digital information that can be provided to patients and families. And as a patient myself, when I receive it, I am extremely grateful. And when I don't, I miss it. And as a nurse, it helps prepare people and give them a sense of control. It certainly doesn't replace the individualized teaching or counseling and discharge preparation, but it certainly supports it. And it actually is very surprising to me that we don't have more resources, but there we are. So to summarize, ERAS guidelines are multimodal care pathways that follow the patient over the course of their surgical care. They address many central elements of the perioperative experience, not sleep, notably, although they do mention that regular sleep-wake cycles can help prevent post-op cognitive dysfunction and delirium, but even as aspirational as ERAS guidelines are, the reality is that hospitals are largely incompatible with sleep, which I suppose is another point for early discharge, what everyone wants to sleep in their own bed. And it's because of the comprehensive nature of the guideline, which is arguably their strength, that ERAS takes organized, persistent effort to actualize.
We spend a lot of time really focusing on the fact that ERAS is the best patient care, according to current best evidence. It is not a project. You are not implementing an ERAS project to see how patients do. The evidence is there. Your patients will do better. It's just we now need to change the way care is done to be in accordance with best evidence. And once that's done, and if you have pre-printed orders, and if you have a patient education sheet or booklet, then it's all there.
We all want to do the best for our patients. Patients want to recover as well and as quickly as possible, to be treated with respect, a sense of inclusion and agency over the process. And we all want a system that performs as well as it can. In order to make that happen, as each of our guests have emphasized, you know, at the most basic level, we need to have a shared sense of how we do things, how we all work together to create an experience for the patient and their family. It's not simple. We're not going to be perfect, but with an attitude of curiosity, openness, teamwork, and humility, using enhanced recovery principles as a guide and supported by meaningful data collection to inform ongoing education, with resources for patients and families, support of technology, and a commitment across all levels, then we can get there. We can achieve better surgical outcomes, and we know it because we've done it. And we continue to build on those efforts. Thank you very much to today's guests, Emily Pearsall, Stuart McCluskey, and Anand Govindarajan.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me.
No problem.
Today.
Thank you. That was great.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
And thank you for listening. Please take a moment to complete a short survey. The link is in the show notes and help me evaluate this podcast. I promise it is short. And leave a rating or a review, because as you know, if you didn't document, you didn't do it. At the Bedside is produced by me, only me. The opinions and ideas do not represent my employers or funders, and I am very grateful to have received some funding for this season from the Registered Nurses Foundation of Ontario Nurse Innovator Award, as well as Sinai Health System in Toronto. You can find At the Bedside Podcast on X, formerly Twitter, and Instagram. I should probably be on TikTok, but I'm working up to it. I'm actually relatively shy. So thank you. Be well. I'll be back here at the bedside in 2 weeks. Hope to see you then.